Hey Carlo, happy birthday, man.
You're never gonna forget this happened. You and me, we're gonna listen to the movie today, after school, 3 o'clock in the parking lot. You try and run, I'm going to track you down. You go to another podcast, it's only going to get worse. You sneak home, I'm going to be on your cell phone. You and me, 3 o'clock.
You got 5 seconds to tell me where you buried the loot.
I don't know if anybody's got the loot.
I'm setting up a guy who's incredibly important to us who's going to tell me where the loot is.
Where's the loot?
Hello, looters. Welcome to the Movie Loot, the podcast where we share the best, greatest, most entertaining, and or weirdest film that you could find. My name is Carlo, and we'll be sharing the loot today, whether it's 3 o'clock or not. This is episode 91, The Birthday Loot, where I will talk about what I saw during the month of August, thanks to all your birthday recommendations. But before we move on to that, we can go on without talking about our previous episodes. Last month, we released episode 90, The Fincher Loot, with guest Richard Dyer. We talked about Fincher and shared our top 5, and I can't be more grateful with Richard. He was a great guest, and to keep on with the Fincher spirit, about a week or two ago, we released special episode 19, where I talk about one scene from Fincher's The Social Network, specifically the scene where Eduardo finally confronts Mark about his shares towards the end of the film. Such a great scene. Before that, in July, we had 2 episodes with Darren Lucas from Movie Reviews 101. He joined the loot and we had the chance to talk about them, so I definitely recommend you to check it out and check out Movie Reviews 101. More recently, we released our September assignment with David Rosen, in which we chose the categories of films to watch during September. David is the host of Piecing It Together podcast and a great friend, and we had a lot of fun choosing what to do this month, so check that out. Finally, something that I had been meaning to share and for some reason kept forgetting it. We've been charting consistently in countries like Brazil, Netherlands, and Switzerland, a bit up and down, but still charting. So we want to thank anybody who's listening from those countries, whether you're in Rotterdam in the Netherlands, or Bern in Switzerland, or Brasilia in Brazil. Thank you very much for the support. I've also been busy with some guest appearances in other podcasts. In the beginning of August, I was a guest on Frank Mendoza's Silver Screeners. This was our 3rd time together. And this time we talk about Alfred Hitchcock's Shadow of a Doubt and Vertigo. A couple of weeks later, I was with Ryan Scott from Sonic Cinema talking about David Fincher's The Game. You see a pattern there? Anyway, this was also my 3rd time at Sonic Cinema, so thanks to Frank and Brian for putting up with my ramblings. It's always a ton of fun to talk with you too. And finally, I was also a guest at Forgotten Filmcast with Todd Libenow, where we talk about Holocaust 2000. This was my 1st time, but it was a pleasure to chat with Todd and to discover this forgotten film. So go check those episodes out if you haven't had enough of me talking. You know you can find those podcasts and the Movie Loot on every podcasting platform. If you're listening through Apple Podcasts or any other platform that allows you to rate or review, please do so. That's one of the best ways to spread the loot and share it with more people. If people see that the show has a good rating, of course they'll be more inclined to check it out. But anyway, let's move on to today's birthday loot, where I will unwrap your film recommendations and talk about what we saw in August. Let's go.
A film from William Friedkin.
I'm going to start with this one because this was a gift from me to me, and it was Sorcerer from 1977. I've been wanting to see this film for a long time. Lots of people have recommended it to me, but like I said in the assignment episode, I really wanted to see Wages of Fear first, which I did last year. So then Friedkin passed away earlier in August, plus he was born in August 29, so I thought it would be a great way to remember him by finally watching this. Sorcerer follows 4 different characters, all of which are wanted and on the run for different reasons, leading them to the remote South American village of Porvenir. We have Irish gangster Jackie, played by Roy Scheider, wealthy investment banker Victor, played by Bruno Kremer. We have Palestinian militant Kassem, played by Amidou, and Mexican hitman Nilo, played by Francisco Rabal. The 4 of them are living the life in Porvenir, living in slums, working odd jobs, and spending the days drinking and thinking about their past. until the opportunity to earn lots of money and get out of this hellhole comes in the form of a dangerous job of driving two trucks loaded with unstable dynamite through the South American jungle. To be honest, once we get past the prologue that shows us how each of the men ended up where they are, the film mostly follows the same template as Wages of Fear, and much like it, it is the perfect representation of constant tension, something that haunts these four characters from wherever they come from to every bar and every jungle road they end up in. I did appreciate the extra depth and background that Friedkin gives the characters in the prologue, and I think it gives a lot of weight to what will happen in the rest of the film. Also, the way that Friedkin, through some great direction, puts us in those trucks and how seamlessly he lets us see where they're driving and how they're driving is so good, extremely well done. There are some really intense sequences, the most notable being them crossing this rickety old bridge. Beyond that, I really love some seemingly small but really key ways in which Friedkin differentiates Sorcerer from Wages of Fear. That actually kept me on my toes and made for a hell of a great watch. My friend Sylvie at Sly_Wit said, great remake, or the greatest remake. And I definitely agree, it has to be up there with some of the greatest remakes. But to continue with Friedkin, from one end of the spectrum to almost the other, I checked out The Guardian from 1990. This was recommended by my man Russell Osborne at No Not Related. Here's what Russell said about it.
Hey Carlo, it's Russell here, just dropping by to give you some thoughts on William Friedkin's 1990 movie, The Guardian. I recommended this to you for two reasons. Firstly, I think it's one of his least known movies, and secondly, I remembered it being a lot of fun. I used to own this on VHS years ago when I first became a horror fan, and I watched it many times. I was drawn to the front cover purely because it said in big letters, "From the director of The Exorcist," which I knew all about even though I hadn't seen it. That must have been at least 25 years ago, so my thoughts may be a bit hazy now, but I'll try my best, and I'll try and avoid some spoilers. Despite its reputation, I like the movie. It's different from the usual Friedkin stuff. The performances are a bit wooden, but Jenny Seagrove is very effective as the sinister British nanny. Her role in this was quite surprising, as she was more known for being the girlfriend of film director Michael Winner at the time. As a horror experience, it isn't particularly scary, but there are some effective practical gore scenes and even a bloodthirsty pack of wolves that provide some extra carnage. Overall, it is, of course, far from Friedkin's best film ever. It doesn't make a lot of sense in places, maybe due to all the script rewrites, and even the man himself said it didn't really work. However, due to all the things I've mentioned, it's certainly worth a watch if you haven't seen it. It has some memorable moments. It's the closest Friedkin ever came to making folk horror, which is a genre I'm a big fan of. And most of all, despite its flaws, it's rarely boring.
Well, first things first, the film follows a young married couple that is going through some changes. The husband was just hired for a new job, they just moved to LA, and they're about to have a baby. That is where Camila, played by Jenny Seagrove, comes in as their lovely new nanny. What they don't know is that Camila is actually a supernatural being that sacrifices babies to a tree entity. I do agree to some extent with Russell. The film has some good moments, and Friedkin is always good at giving you that sense of uneasiness and danger. Unfortunately, here it is paired with some weak performances and a script that feels a bit unsure of what to be. Is it fantasy? Is it horror? Is it an erotic thriller? There are elements of all of that, even though some of those elements don't necessarily lead anywhere. I also think the whole logistics of Camila's goals are a bit of a mess, and the film just feels a bit cheap and mediocre in some aspects, but it still has that sense of dread and some worthy horror elements that some might enjoy. So thanks, Russell. A film from the 80s. This next one was a recommendation from my friend Josh from your next favorite movie, and it was 3 O'Clock High from 1987. This is an 80s teen comedy that for some reason I didn't check out, even though I grew up watching 80s comedies. My friend Josh said, glad to see you checking it out. I just watched it for the first time a few years back, and much like you, was surprised I'd somehow missed this growing up. So the film follows Meek student and school journalist Jerry Mitchell, played by Casey Simasco, who is tasked by the school newspaper to interview new student / juvenile delinquent Buddy Rebel, played by Richard Tyson. But of course, things go awry when Jerry awkwardly approaches Buddy in the school restroom, something that Buddy's not happy about, hence the titular threat, "You and me, 3 o'clock. But yeah, I was surprised I hadn't seen it, and moreover, really happy when it ended up being quite a pleasant and enjoyable surprise. 3 O'Clock High lives in the same space as other teen films of the era that walk within that suburban magical realism realm. And if you're interested in that topic, suburban magical realism, then check out episode 63 with Keira Maliki Sanchez, where we talk about that topic. But anyway, I'm talking about films like Better Off Dead, License to Drive, films with events grounded in reality, but that are presented in ways that make them feel they're not. This is done to help heighten the dread, the tension, and the feelings of being trapped by the main character, usually in hilarious ways. My friend Mel Valentin, at Real Mel Valentin, said, "Assume you know who the cinematographer was and what he went on to do. Either way, I remember this one fondly." What Mel is referring to is that this was shot by Barry Sonnenfeld, who later went on to become the director of the Addams Family movies of the 90s, Get Shorty, and most important, the Men in Black movies. So he and director Phil Juneau, they do a fantastic job. The way they move the camera, the angles they show, how they block certain scenes, it was definitely above the average teen movie standards. Aside from that, the two leads, Simasco and Tyson, are pretty solid, although I think I would have liked a bit more development for the character of Buddy. 3 O'Clock High also subverts certain tropes of the genre. There are a couple of times where you think it's going to zig, but then it zags, which was refreshing. The last act did felt less interesting than what could have been, and I didn't like how they handled the two female characters, both of which end up being Jerry's romantic interest, but still, with two of them, the script didn't seem to know what to do or where to go with them. Either way, I thought the film was a refreshing take on the teen school subgenre, well acted, neatly directed and shot, and maybe giving more credit to its audience than most films of that subgenre do. My friend Todd from Forgotten Filmcast said, 3 O'Clock High is my favorite teen comedy of the 80s. It's so original and visually creative. And I definitely agree with Todd. This is one of the best teen comedies of the 80s I've seen. So thanks to Josh for the recommendation. A film from the Sight and Sound Greatest Films list, whose ranking includes the number 8. For this category, my friend Ian from Best Film Ever recommended 1970s The Conformist from Bernardo Bertolucci, which is tied in the list as 118. The film follows Marcello Clerici, played by Jean-Louis Trintignant, a fascist that is instructed to assassinate his former mentor and professor, but things get complicated when he starts a relationship with the professor's wife. So here's what Ian had to say about the film.
Hey, it's Ian from Best Film Ever here, and it's just a little message to talk to Carlo and the Movie Loot about The Conformist, Bertolucci's The Conformist, a film that, if you look at it, has its fingerprints all over 1970 cinema. You can't look at The Godfather without seeing elements of The Conformist. Besides its tone, which is ambiguous and haunting, I mean, the elements of the protagonist, the titled conformist, and his ability to shapeshift to the needs of his situation, how it surrounds him, whether it's political affiliation, whether it's sexuality, whether it's fulfilling just basically any expectation, the ability to survive. We see that represented stylistically in things such as the drastic Dutch angles throughout large portions of the film and his constant presence in them. We see them in the violation of the 180-degree rule, where he flips both sides. And if you think about what's going to happen with his affiliation and his sexuality in this film, we see that same flexibility, the same ability to present himself almost without reprimand in these two situations. And then finally, I mean, you have to acknowledge, I think, what's one of the great scores of the 1970s to create a backbone of a soundscape that the espionage and the haunting sense of almost sexual foreboding throughout this film maintained. So I had to watch this for a course at university, and it was a long list of films that I was just kind of gonna put up with and found myself really quite captivated by. So when it came up as an option to recommend Carlo for the Movie Loot, how could I not go ahead and throw that one down as a recommendation from your friends over here at the BFE? That's Best Film Ever. So Carlo, thanks again for letting me chip in. You do good stuff, and hoping to get you back on the show again very, very shortly. But to everybody out there in podcast land, if you're not hitting subscribe to the Movie Loot, you are missing out. And with that, I'll catch you on the flippity flap.
This is a film I had barely heard of, but when Ian brought it up and I read the plot synopsis, I was immediately intrigued, and I agree with what Ian said in how the ambiguity of the main character and his loyalties make for an interesting film. Bertolucci uses a non-linear narrative that starts with Marcello preparing for his mission, but then goes back and forth to different moments in his past that shows us the things that led him to where he is now. I do think that the film felt a bit scattered, and it took me a while to get into the film's wavelength, but I really appreciated all the layers to the main character. I love how Ian described him as a shapeshifter, which he is in many ways, but that can also apply to the film, which might have some lighter elements here and there in the first half, but then turns really dark and bleak as it goes on. The cinematography and direction were also great, but overall, I felt like I missed something. Knowing myself, I felt that this film should have hit harder for me than it actually did. I still liked it, but it's a film I feel I should revisit again. So thanks to Ian for a great recommendation, one that I most definitely will go back to at some point. A film mostly set on a plane. National Aviation Day was in August 19, which is Orville Wright's birthday. This is a day to celebrate the development of aviation, which is why I had this category. For it, someone that I don't know on Twitter, Andrew at Desert Granite, recommended Flight Plan from 2005. This film follows airplane engineer Kyle Pratt, played by Jodie Foster, as she and her young daughter Julia board the plane that will transport the body of her recently deceased husband from Germany to the US. But things get complicated when shortly after takeoff, Julia disappears, but nobody seems to have any recollection or evidence of the girl ever boarding the plane. So the film follows Kyle's efforts to find her while also trying to keep her sanity and convince the crew and herself that her daughter is actually missing. My friend Sylvie said, why not just watch The Lady Vanishes? And that's because the plot is very similar to that classic from Alfred Hitchcock, except first, that one takes place on a train, not a plane, and that one actually ends up getting more complex, darker, and better as it goes on. Flight Plan? Not so much. The film does start with a mildly interesting premise, but becomes less and less interesting and more generic as it goes on. And that's really what breaks the film. Despite that interesting premise, what ends up really happening doesn't quite compute neither logically nor story-wise. The amount of things that had to happen for what actually happened to happen is laughable and ludicrous. But the twist, if we can call it that, is so formulaic that the film pretty much deflates afterwards. And still, the writers decide to stretch things on for about 20-25 minutes more, even though it's clear they didn't really know what to do. The only thing that kind of gives this some points is a strong cast. Jodie Foster is truly giving the film her all, especially in the first two acts. You really get the desperation and mental anguish of her character as she tries to internalize what is happening. Peter Sarsgaard is also pretty good as an air marshal that tries to handle the different situations in the plane. Sean Bean, who plays the captain, does his best, but his role is really not that significant. But anyway, I don't regret watching it, so Andrew, I don't know you, but I really appreciate the recommendation, and feel free to let me know what you think about the film. A film from the Ivory Coast. Côte d'Ivoire, or Ivory Coast, celebrates its independence from France in August 7, a movement that was led by Félix Houphouët-Boigneux, a physician that served as the country's first president from 1960 to 1993. That's why I had this category, and for it, I got a recommendation from my friend Sylvie, and it's called Night of the Kings from 2020. This is what Sylvie had to say about it.
Happy birthday, Carlo! Knowing you wanted to watch a movie from Côte d'Ivoire, and that one of your favorite movies of all time is a prison film, my present to you is Night of the Kings. On the surface, Night of the Kings is the story of a power struggle among prisoners at La Maca, the main prison of Abidjan. However, at its heart, it is a tale about storytelling and performance. The story centers on a new arrival at the prison, who is chosen by the ailing leader, in part as a distraction, to be the new Rommel, the storyteller for the Night of the Red Moon. It soon becomes clear that being Rommel is a serious and dangerous job. However, what is not clear is whether the new Rommel will be up to the task. This storytelling aspect is what I loved about this movie. Watching Rommel incorporate what he is seeing around him in the prison into the story, weaving in elements of local folklore as he goes, all while being echoed by a sort of Greek chorus of prisoners in the background. Rommel in French literally means novel or story, and that's what we see Rommel become, the embodiment of the story he's telling. A modern-day Scheherazade by way of The Usual Suspects. I hope you enjoyed it.
So So Sylvie already explained what the film is about more eloquently than I would have explained it. This is a film I hadn't heard of until a couple of months ago, but I really enjoy exploring new films from other countries and cultures, and this was no exception. Like Sylvie said, the way the film weaves local folklore, storytelling, and other cultural aspects of Côte d'Ivoire is mesmerizing. The film doesn't really dwell that much in the power struggle between the prison leader Blackbeard and his ambitious subordinate slash successor, or in the logistics of how or why Ramon has to tell these stories until the red moon sets. Instead, the film puts you right in the middle of this hypnotizing ceremony to perhaps let you experience it in the same trance-like state as the prisoners. Much like Ramon's stories, the film weaves in and out of certain characters and subplots, maybe leaving us asking for more. I would have loved to see more from characters like Blackbeard, and the film certainly loses a bit of oomph when he's not in. But again, being captured in the middle of this ceremony, see it unfold in this haze and dreamlike state was quite something. So thanks, Sylvie, for yet another worthy recommendation. Speaking of Sylvie, as I enter into the other random watches I had in August, there's one that she often recommended to me, and that was 1932's The Old Dark House. She described it to me as the best of my favorite horror subgenre. And it really is. The Old Dark House is a really effective ghost house story with a solid ensemble cast and a great use of atmosphere and dread. And speaking of effective atmosphere, I also checked out John Carpenter's The Fog. This is a film that I'm pretty sure I saw when I was a kid, but I barely remembered anything. My friend Ed from the Film Effect podcast brought it up when we recorded the Horror Loot about 2 years ago, and he described it as one of my all-time favorites. So I finally checked it out. And yeah, the best thing the film has is that eerie and dread-filled atmosphere that the film patiently builds around this curse that has befallen the town of Antonio Bay that opens the door for the arrival of this ghost. My friend Sylvie said, it's hard to pick a favorite Carpenter, but this one is up there. My friend Tim Dougherty said, love this one. Sort of got lost in his classics, but it's excellent craft and superb vibes. Spooky Movie Geek at Movie Ultimate said, watch this the other night, show it to my lad, he enjoyed it, I love it anyway, classic. Darren Lumber from NostalgiaCast said, have fun with it, I certainly do, and then listen to my chat with Screen Run in part 4 of their season-long retrospective on Carpenter's career. On the other hand, Wayne from In Film We Trust said, watched it for the first time last year, I think. I liked it, but it wasn't top-tier Carpenter for me. And Brian Clarkson said, The Fog had good atmosphere to it, but it doesn't quite cohere in the same way that Halloween did a few years prior. From fictional atmosphere and dread, we move to a real one. I saw a short documentary called The Dyatlov Pass Case from 2016. This was written and directed by a YouTube creator called Lemino, who likes to release short documentaries on various real-life topics. So this one follows the case about 9 Soviet hikers that ventured into the Siberian mountains in 1959, only to be all found dead near the titular pass under mysterious circumstances. The documentary is simple, but it is well-structured and engaging, and you can find it on YouTube. I also rewatched David Fincher's The Game, but you can hear all my thoughts about it on the episode I recorded for Sonic Cinema with Brian Scottle. About The Game, Jack Carrick said, just watched this last night myself. Lots of great little performances and really good cinematography. Michael Douglas and Sean Penn are so much like brothers too. Great casting. Tim Dougherty said, has one of my favorite shots ever. Michael Douglas waking up in a Mexican cemetery and crawling out of his crypt. My friend Dan at Hogstan Dan said, let's fucking go! My favorite Fincher, a top fave of all time. Brian Clarkson said, The Game might be minor Fincher, but the pieces do come together for a solidly entertaining thriller. So I'm glad that this film is getting some newfound attention, because it's really good. So check out the film if you haven't, and check my episode at Sonic Cinema. To close things out, I also rewatched David Fincher's Zodiac, obviously part of my Fincher journey as I was preparing for that Fincher episode with it. This is a great film, again, full of atmosphere and dread as we follow 3 different characters determined and obsessed to capture the Zodiac killer. My friend Sylvie said, great Fincher, or the greatest Fincher? Not the greatest for me, but it's up there. It's my second favorite Fincher. If you don't know me well enough and you want to know what my favorite Fincher is, check out the Fincher Loot. So that was my birthday loot. I want to thank everybody for recommending films. I only had 5 categories this year, but there were a few other people that recommended films, and even though I didn't get to them, I want to thank them. My friend Brian Clarkson dropped like 100 recommendations, Obi-Wan Kenobi, and Fico Canjiano from Cine Express. Thanks to all. Your recommendations are on the watch list, so when I get to them, I'll let you know. As usual, feel free to check out any of these films I talk about today and let us know what you think, because we love getting feedback from people that get something from the loot. If you want to do that, you can find the podcast on Twitter at TMML2021 and Blue Sky at The Movie Loot. You can find me personally on both Twitter and Blue Sky at TFCGD. You can also use those social platforms to let us know what you think of the show, film recommendations, or just engage with us, because that's what I love most of this, to talk film with people. As you know, the podcast is available on pretty much every audio and podcasting platform, from Apple Podcasts and Spotify to Google Podcasts and Good Pods and everything in between. You can also check out our Patreon, which is available at patreon.com/movieloot. If there's a topic you want to talk about, you want to be on the show, Patreon it is. So that'll be until the next episode, and remember the lesson that 3 o'clock high taught us, not to touch random strangers in public school restrooms. See ya!